Stripe is the go-to choice for AI companies, from early-stage startups to scaled enterprises. 78% of the leading AI companies use Stripe to go to market quickly and scale globally. That includes pioneers like NVIDIA, OpenAI, and Perplexity. Stripe has developed cutting-edge tools to improve everything from fraud detection to checkout optimization. Whether you're aiming for incremental gains or planning for enterprise transformation, see how Stripe can help at stripe.com.
You know where your business would be without you. Imagine where it could go with more of you. Well, with Wix, you can create a website with more of your vision, your voice, your expertise. Wix gives you the freedom to truly own your brand and do it on your own, with full customization and advanced AI tools that help turn your ideas into reality. Grow your business into your online brand. Because without you, your business is just business as usual. Go to Wix.com.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, this.
The talks in Geneva were very friendly. The relationship is very good. We're not looking to hurt China. China was being hurt very badly, and they were very happy to be able to do something with us. And the relationship is very, very good.
It's being billed as the most important deal of Trump's many deals. And today we ask if the reduction on tariffs between the US and China will hold and what it means for the rest of world trade. Also, with a staggering $84 trillion set to be gifted from boomers to Gen X and millennials, we look at the issues around intergenerational wealth. And we're going to have a look at the economics of charity shops and ask, has their time finally come? Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on social media at X, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Blue Sky at Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Now, I'm going to start off this week by explaining what the concept of elasticity is. So, if the price of something goes up, you think the demand would go down, but probably not in equal measure. And it's the measure of that is actually what elasticity is. So, let's say, for example, I love an Americano with oat milk. And if the price of that went up by 10%, I probably would still buy it, of course. But if it doubled, I might buy less of it or I might change to drinking tea. Now, there's three things that drive elasticity. So whether it's a need or a want, which, by the way, my Americano with oat milk is a need, whether you have close substitutes and how closely you can actually get access to them, and how much of your income you spend on it. So since I spend a relatively little amount on this, then, of course, then that makes me less elastic when it comes to that coffee. Now, the reason I bring this up today is because elasticity is often what determines how much you pay for things, because businesses know that at some stage, the elastic band can snap. So, first up today, we're focusing on a major development in global trade, the latest agreement between the United States and China. After years of tensions and a particularly disruptive couple of months of tariffs and tit-for-tat measures, the world's two largest economies have struck a deal aimed at easing restrictions and opening the door to further cooperation. So to help us unpack what this means for global markets, industries and geopolitics, I'm joined by Ian Curran, business reporter at the Irish Times. Ian, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much.
So we're going to start off with the root cause of these tariffs, because the US buys much more from China than the other way around. So the US buys $440 billion and instead then China buys $145 billion of the US's goods. Can you walk us through the history of the US-Chinese relationship, please, that has got us to this point?
Well, I think really since the 1980s, the 1990s, there's been an opening up of the relationship between the United States and China, in which they became sort of very important trading partners. Obviously, that had its genesis in the 1970s, I think, with Richard Nixon when he was president, and the kind of the push that he and Henry Kissinger put together to kind of take advantage of the split between China and the Soviet Union at the time, and to kind of put its stamp on China and to establish those relations. Obviously, this relationship is hugely lucrative to both sides, but it's become a point of contention for Trump and something that he campaigned on, not just in the second round of elections, but in the first, back when he was elected in 2016. China is a byword for the kind of the bad deals that the US gets internationally, and I think that that's motivated largely by the success of the Chinese economy, its growing importance in the world, and this kind of shift to what some commentators would say, see or argue is increasingly becoming a multipolar world, and as United States' economic and kind of diplomatic monopoly on global affairs has kind of started to wane a little bit, and certainly we can see the Trump tariffs, I think, in that context.
Well, it looks like it was heading for $600 billion in two-way trade was being disrupted due to this escalating trade war. And then, of course, we saw earlier on this week it was announced that there was a US-China deal. But is it a deal?
Yeah, I think the best way to describe it perhaps is more of a truce than an actual deal itself. I think just to go back, I mean, I think because of the sort of pageantry around the tariffs announcement on April 2nd, what Donald Trump called Liberation Day. Yeah, exactly. We've kind of forgotten what Trump did initially when he came in, which was to kind of slap tariffs on a lot of different countries, including China. And to be honest, the discussions that have taken place between the US and China and many of its trading partners have been about those, you know, those tariffs, and particularly in the case of China, where there were tariffs announced on Liberation Day, and then there was a ratcheting up of tariffs and counter tariffs and that kind of thing in the days afterwards. So the deal or the truce that they've negotiated over the past few days is very important, certainly. But what it does is it gives them 90 days in which the tariffs kind of reduce back down, not to zero, but back to where they were before the kind of ratcheting up that happened, the tit for tat in the days after April 2nd. It gives them 90 days to come to some sort of a more permanent deal. And certainly it's good news, I think. And you've seen that with how the stock markets have reacted. Logistics companies, are doing quite well in the short term. I think people are expecting shipping rates to go up. But certainly the tariffs aren't coming back down to zero. And we can talk a little bit maybe about the implications of that as well.
Before we get to that, could we just look at things from a sectoral point of view? Because if you look around the Chinese economy, as you alluded to there earlier, like clean energy accounted for a record 10% of China's GDP and drove a quarter of its growth last year, yet it's the largest greenhouse gas emitter. And I was talking to a conference academic organizer the other day, and he was saying the vast number of paper submissions about AI are coming from China. So which sectors are the winners and the losers from this pause?
People have been shocked, I think, to be honest, at the kind of speed of development and innovation in the Chinese economy over the last little while. There was a sort of an opinion or a sort of a take on China that, yes, it was a very kind of, let's say, muscle-bound economy. It was the factory of the world and that kind of thing up until very recently. But actually, some of the technological advances that we have seen have shocked Western commentators. And there has been, as you said, clean energy is one in particular. So I think that sort of view of China has changed significantly. And I think, there are people probably in Silicon Valley who are starting to see China directly as a threat in terms of actual technological innovation. A lot of critics of Silicon Valley would say a big problem with the tech sector in the US and the kind of tech sector that we know here is it hasn't innovated very much over the last, 10 or 12 years. It's been focused on its core products and improving them. Obviously, AI is changing that a little bit. But tech is very much, I think, right at the foreground. And we know that the tech industry in Silicon Valley has Donald Trump's ear as well. So I think that that's an important factor.
But while it might have his ear, the reality is that he's cutting public money, or Doge, we'll say, is cutting public money into research, which has been driving this on. Whereas on the other hand, that's being increased in China. In the US, it's drill, baby, drill. And in China, they're increasing their investment in clean energy. I mean, there's a real diversion here, tariffs aside, isn't there?
Yeah, well, look, I think you're speaking to something that is very evident here, even just to take it back to the tariffs conversation itself. There is a bit of a cognitive dissonance in the way that the Trump administration appears to be approaching these issues. Like, if you just look at tariffs, for example, the central idea of tariffs is about trying to bring American jobs back to America, the jobs that were lost to China in the 1990s, the 1980s, and after that, and other producer economies, that kind of thing, or whatever. And look, most orthodox economists would say, that this isn't going to work. But let's say it did work. Let's say it did sort of incentivize American companies to come back to the United States. The Trump administration doesn't really have a plan to reindustrialize. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really have a matching plan to make places that have lost jobs, your Clevelands or your Rust Belt cities, back into economic powerhouses. And there is a bit of a disjuncture. People are waiting for more detail on that kind of thing. saying. And I think you're right that there is a sort of a cognitive dissonance there in a lot of these policies, an erratic kind of nature to them as well, you know?
Well, if we also look at one of the key outcomes of the truce, I'm looking for new words for this. We said truce, we've said deal, we've said pause. But one of the things that stands out here, of course, is that China is now allowing the export of critical minerals again. So this wasn't just about, you know, dropping to the 30% or the 10%. It was about what is allowed out. So how might the fact that China allowing the export of critical minerals and other things like that affect global supply chains, particularly in the technology sectors, like you were mentioning?
Yeah, I think you can even look at it a bit more generally. After the sort of ratcheting up of the tariffs between the United States and China to the point where they were before this deal was agreed, I can't remember the exact figure, 155% or something like that was the total US tariff on Chinese imports or that kind of thing.
145.
But
what's the difference between friends at that
stage? Exactly, yeah. I think we're all losing track of the numbers. They're getting so big. But so if you just look at that, basically what exporters and supply chain experts you're saying is that that was effectively an embargo on Chinese goods, and a lot of kind of shipping companies and freight forwarders and that kind of thing effectively just didn't handle any goods between the US and China over the last kind of month or so or whatever. That's hugely disruptive. And as if we've learned anything from COVID, I think we've learned that international supply chains, they're incredibly complex, interconnected, and they're very fragile as well. So I think what you saw was a lot of kind of shuffling of the deck chairs, where people trying to move, their supply chains around to get around China or out, you know, that kind of thing. And what you're hearing is, as a consequence of this deal, that is still taking place, but it's probably not as dramatic. And I think that there will be knock-on effects. Like, we probably will see an immediate boom in shipping, which will lead to higher prices, which will feed through to potentially to higher goods on the prices for goods on the shelves. We know that was a factor in the post-COVID era and that kind of thing. So it is just this, you know, the snowball effect. And I think it remains to be seen exactly how it all plays out. But I think these are some of the things that, you know, to think about when it comes to supply chains and the trade war.
Ian, do you know what I think we're at risk of in this conversation? Not this one specifically, but in the whole US-China conversation, is tariffs are still higher now than they were a couple of weeks ago. I'm just going to read you out a quote here from the Walmart earnings call, because it was the first big box retailer that had their earnings out since Liberation Day. And the CEO said, "We will do our best to keep our prices as low as possible, but given the magnitude of the tariffs, even at the reduced levels announced this week, we aren't able to absorb all the pressure given the reality of narrow retail margins." Yet, we also got the figures out this week from US inflation that is now 2.3%. And basically, the headline was tariffs hasn't impacted that, which of course it hasn't, because it hadn't factored them in yet. When do we expect the impact of existing tariffs, the existing paused ones, right, so now at the levels of the 30% on China, affecting the US economy?
It's a good question. I think everyone wants to know the answer to that question. I don't have the answer, but I do think it's certainly something to be sort of to be looked at. And look, as you say, I think the key thing is here, like, even if an agreement is reached in the next 90 days, tariffs are still dramatically higher than they were, you know, at 30% for China and 10% effectively for the rest of the world. They're not going back to zero. And I think the consequences of that remain to be seen, you know, particularly for Irish exporters, for example, in lieu of a sort of an EU-US trade deal, that kind of thing. But I think that there is consensus that tariffs will be inflationary, and it is a question of when rather than whether it will happen at all.
And apart from the price impact of tariffs, I mean, we have to talk about fentanyl, and there's other elements being woven into this deal. It's not just about prices, like we talked there about an embargo on goods, but the fact that the 20% differential between the two countries is now down to fentanyl. How does things like managing the import or export of a drug or trafficking of a drug impact on a trade deal? Like, how does that actually really affect diplomatic matters?
Well, I think it's very interesting in one sense that a lot of these tariffs and in particular, I'm just thinking of the review that's ongoing into pharma exports, which we know, for example, have been kept out of the initial tariffs agenda. European pharmaceutical exports, mm-hmm. obviously affecting the Irish pharma sector. Those reviews are taking place not under sort of a trade or an economic framework. They're actually taking place under a national security framework in the United States. So it is that sort of, as you say, that's kind of where it comes in. Trump sees these as and partially that's, I think, there's an efficacy there in the sense that it allows him to do things quicker if it is sort of related to national security, whether it's about protecting American citizens from fentanyl and that kind of thing. But it is just a very interesting sort of shift in how these things are done. It's not being viewed necessarily through the economic framework. It is some of these issues, particularly around pharma, you mentioned fentanyl, are being viewed under that kind of national security rubric. So it does sort of add a dimension to the whole discussion, I think.
When you say a national rubric, if we take a look around the world right now, we probably see the most imbalanced relationship that the US has would be with China. And based on what we saw, particularly last week with the UK, we could say probably the most balanced, well, among them, a balanced relationship with the UK. So would we now say that the UK, with their strong relationship, has a universal tariff of 10%. China, with its less balanced relationship, has a tariff rate of 30%. Is this the ceiling and the floor we're looking at?
It's very hard to say. And I think like that's something, you know, that needs to be discussed as well in a way. Like, I think what's happened and the kind of erratic nature, the way things have gone up and down and been announced and pulled back and paused for 90 days and so on, has eroded confidence in the ability of markets to actually figure out what's happening in the United States. But then just like that, to even sort of to ask those kind of bigger picture questions about where is this all going in terms of the United States' relationships with its partners and that kind of thing. And I think that is something, you know, when you look at it just purely from a markets perspective, from a business perspective, I think that kind of volatility is going to be baked into a lot of what happens over the rest of the year, the trading year. I think a lot of investors are seeing that sort of uncertainty. And as we said, you know, tariffs aren't going back to zero. And who knows what he might announce next.
Well, on that note, thank you so much indeed, Ian Curran, business reporter at the Irish Times, for a really fascinating trip right around the world. Really appreciate you coming into studio today.
Thanks very much.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask if the globe is ready for a massive intergenerational wealth transfer. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And before we move on, I want to share with you some messages that we received from last week. So first of all, I heard a lot of agreement with the 358 policy at the ECB. Many of you told me that you feel it's important to keep people moving to upskill. I want to say thank you to Cullum, who was listening to the show when on holidays in Greece, to Barbara, who told us that she took us on her walk the morning after she landed in Toronto, as well as to Ronan, who listens to the show every week with his mother, Anne, on a Sunday morning. Thank you to Catherine, who sent me a lovely message saying it was interesting to hear about my mother and why she doesn't want a mobile phone. And please do let us know where you're listening from and what you think about when it comes to our topics, as we really do love to hear from you. Now, we're going to talk about intergenerational wealth transfer, because by 2045, a staggering $84 trillion is set to move from boomers to Gen X and millennials. And this is going to affect every person and every household right across the developed world. And it does raise critical questions about the impact on the economy and society and the financial decisions that we make. Joining me now to talk about these issues is Warwick Bloor at Vanguard. Warwick, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Warwick, first of all, when we look in Europe, $3.5 trillion is going to change hands between generations by 2030. What is the impact of this on the economy and society?
So it's a huge amount of money, and this is often characterized as the great wealth transfer. It's called great simply because wealth is held disproportionately by the older generations, and we're at a point now where the expected transfer in the coming years is more than it's ever been in the past. Now, in terms of society, what this means is that there's going to be a lot of variability in the amount that people get. Some people will get a fairly modest amount. Other people will get a huge amount relative to the earnings that they're likely to have over a lifetime. The age at which people tend to get inheritances doesn't tend to be on the younger side, in the 20s and the 30s. You actually see this more in the sort of late 40s, going to the 50s and the 60s. So what this means is that a big chunk of society, they would expect to get a large financial injection probably as they get into their late 40s and 50s. Now, they need to figure out what to do with it. They need to get prepared. They need to make sure that they hold on to it in a responsible manner. In terms of the economy, now, money changing hands certainly can have an impact on the economy. Remember, too, that part of that is tax. So not all of that is going to be transferred. It's going to be an injection to the government. And ultimately, it depends on what these people do with it. If they spend it on paying off the mortgages, then it's likely to be less of an impact. If they spend it more on consumption, then that will have a stimulating effect. It's difficult to say, really. There's a number of moving parts there.
Let's talk about the tax point. 24 out of 36 OECD countries have an inheritance tax, the others don't. And in Ireland and the UK, inheritance tax represents around about 0.7% of the tax take. Now, if you think about, as you just mentioned there, this great wealth transfer, do you think that that the policies of government should change to increase those taxes then?
I think it's difficult to say. So you could get quite philosophical about it. You could get quite political. But you're right, which is inheritance tax doesn't include a large proportion of the overall tax take of these countries. Interestingly, what's happened in the UK is the government have increased, or at least they propose to increase the taxes that they will collect on death. Previously in the UK, pensions which were left unspent weren't taxed. From 2027, the expectation is that they will if the legislation goes through. So clearly governments are thinking about ways they can increase the revenue here. Obviously, some people will be comfortable with that as an idea. Other people will be less comfortable with it.
There are many things to do, though, when it comes to the impact on social mobility. And one of the big concerns with what we're talking about here is, does intergenerational wealth transfer entrench inequality? And particularly, let's say, if you are, let's say today, for anybody who's listening, and they want to enable the next generation to be able to move up, we'll say, a social and economic ladder. That's what social mobility is. They can invest in their education. They can have maybe help them own a home, pay down debt, teach them how to invest well, give them money to invest, etc. But is this wealth transfer really and truly going to have an irreversible effect on inequality?
So if you look at some of the studies that were done, for example, by the IFS, the Institute of Financial Studies in the UK, then they call this out specifically, which is there is a lot of variability and polarization in terms of the amount of money that people are likely to get, with those wealthy parents ending up bequesting a much more serious amount of money than those towards the low end of the scale. So their argument is, yes, this does persist in terms of inequality there. In terms of ensuring the transfer is smooth regardless, then you're right, which is education around finances plays a big part here if you're going to be inheriting. But clearly, education around finances, it's important for anyone who's looking to, you know, build up wealth or manage their affairs in a sensible manner.
Well, if we niche down now into a very sore point, certainly in this country, and I know it's the same over where you are, and that's about housing. When I looked into this, in the UK, half of first-time buyers in 2024 received help from families. And in Australia, 60% of first-time buyers now get family help with the deposits. Do you remember before, Warwick, we used to say that when the second person in the household started earning money, well, then, of course, that really made a big jump for housing in house prices. Is there now the third party in the case of the bank of mum and dad when it comes to people buying houses for the first time, which drives an even bigger wedge with affordability?
Yes, I very much agree that that's the case. If you look at the bank of mum and dad, then in the UK, at least, it's regarded as the biggest lender. So whether someone gets a property deposit or not makes a big difference to the speed with which they could get on the housing ladder. And I think this feeds into the great wealth transfer as well, because what people certainly in the UK are doing is they're thinking, right, if I don't spend my money when I'm in my 60s, then it's going to end up getting taxed. So one of the things I can do is the gifting side of things, which indeed a number of people are doing, especially after we had a budget last year where the expectation is that more tax will be taken upon someone's death. So clearly those people are starting to think a bit more about the gifting. But yes, it does drive up the cost of housing simply because you're increasing demand, because people do have the ability to get those larger properties earlier in the first instance because they have had help from the Bank of Mum and Dad.
So the Bank of Mum and Dad is the biggest lender in the UK today?
It is, yeah.
Wow. Can we then also just talk about the pressure that that puts on older people then? Because in terms of savings, are older people, and not just mums and dads, but grandmums and dads and great-grandmums and dads, are they then saving more, spending less, with the view to making sure that there is enough left in their legacy to leave to their adult children and grandchildren? I mean, is this affecting the whole life cycle of savings?
I think it depends on personality, and it depends on objectives and how you feel really about the importance of legacy versus spending. So in my previous life before joining Vanguard, I was a financial advisor. So I ended up meeting a lot of people who were thinking about you know, what they want to do for the next generation versus what they want to spend themselves. And I could tell you there's a whole spectrum. You may have heard the expression skiers. It's a term which gained a bit of popularity probably in the last 20 years, which is this idea of you'd retired, that's your money to enjoy, you're looking to spend every last penny, optimise in that way. But on the other hand, you have people towards the other end of the spectrum where they're not interested in having an extravagant lifestyle, and they know that life is more difficult often for the next generation, so they place a higher value on the legacy. So it can be either, really. I imagine that pressures affect people in both directions, but in my experience, it comes down to the personality and the goals that people have.
Can we talk about the other side of it then, and particularly from your perspective of being an advisor, how does the expectation of getting an inheritance affect a person's financial decisions?
So that's a really interesting one, actually. So I had a stat recently, which is, I think it was 36% of millennials are building expected inheritances into their own financial planning. And I spent a lot of time talking to financial advisors because that's the role that I perform at Vanguard. And they tend to be quite conflicted around this because many of them are just super cautious on it. Because when you're receiving an inheritance, you've actually got no idea what the amount is, and you've got no idea when you're going to get it. So pinning your entire retirement, let's say, on the expectation you're going to get an inheritance, then that's a pretty dangerous strategy, because we all know that, you know, care can be expensive. If someone has to pay for care, that can erode a big chunk of one's inheritance, and therefore you may end up getting nothing, actually. So it's quite a dangerous game to play if you rely on it too much. On the other end of the spectrum, I've noticed a bit of a trend, which is that younger people, they are taking out mortgages which are higher than they necessarily expect to pay themselves during their lifetime, with the expectation that they're going to get an inheritance which will extinguish that. And that was kind of to your point earlier about potentially the bank of mum and dad or something similar inflating the property market. If someone does that, then clearly there's a risk involved, but they do have the option to downsize in the future if the inheritance doesn't materialize. So I think overall, you're taking a big risk if you gamble too much on the expectation you're going to get an inheritance. But of course, if there's a very high chance this is going to happen, people, you know, naturally do start to build that at least a bit into their planning.
And Mark, everything we're talking about here is very logical so far in our conversation, but I want to get into the emotional side of it as well, because financial planning involves tax, assets and family politics. How do you navigate all three?
That's a challenging one. I mean, we could perhaps put politics to one side at the moment and maybe talk about the tax side and the family planning. So I kind of think about the tax side as being the IQ side of estate planning, which is, you know, you need to know all the legislation, you need to know the options that people have available, and you need to help them figure out technically what is the right and sensible plan, navigating, of course, the uncertainty, because no one knows how long their life is going to be. No one knows exactly what's going to happen to their circumstances. The family dynamic side, that's kind of more of the EQ side. And, you know, to be frank, that can get quite complicated. That can get quite messy. You can see, for example, in the UK, there are 10,000 wills contested a couple of years ago. So that gives you an idea of how people could get into sometimes quite bitter arguments around the finances. So I think you have a few problems when it comes to this kind of family dynamic. The biggest one is that people don't prepare properly. And as part of that, people don't really talk to each other within the family about wealth, particularly in the UK, probably the same thing in Ireland. It's a bit of a taboo subject where people don't like to bring it up at the dinner table. It's perhaps slightly different in other countries, but we certainly have a bit of an issue of not talking about it. Because we don't talk about it, the plan just doesn't get implemented properly. People leave it too late, and that's why you get into a bit of a mess. So I think in terms of, you know, what people should be doing is they should broach the subject earlier. They should give themselves a little bit of a push to talk about the topic in the right way rather than leaving it unspoken about and potentially a bit of a mess when the time comes.
Well, to move from the emotional side to the psychological side, people invest differently based on how they got their money. So if I earn £100, I might use that money differently than if I simply had won it on a scratch card, let's just say. And I found it interesting that a Bank of America survey found that younger generations allocate three times more of their portfolio to alternative investments, and that could be private equity or startup or, of course, crypto assets. We also know that younger investors tend to factor in ESG. And for that, for listeners who are unfamiliar with that term, that's environmental, social and governance factors into their investing. What are the knock-on effects that you're seeing at the moment about how money is moving into these assets? Is there a demographic difference?
So I think it depends what data you look at, because you can find studies which show that younger investors have a pretty strong preference for sustainable investments. But you can also find studies which show that this is a fairly modest preference and it tends to disappear if performance doesn't materialize in this space compared to something which isn't ESG focused. I think younger generations, from experience, they are gaining greater awareness of other asset classes than perhaps the previous generations did. I think part of that is the rise in social media. You know, things trend, people gain awareness of different things, good and bad, through that aspect. So I can see there are slightly different preferences, but to be very concrete about what this actually means, it kind of depends on the study that you look at here.
And from a business point of view, then, if we move away from the individual inheriting the money and move to an individual inheriting a business, I saw in a piece that you had written recently that was quoted in the FT, from a business point of view, you said that up to 70% of wealthy families lose their wealth by the next generation and as many as 90% lose their wealth by the third generation. Why, Warwick?
So that stat came from a fairly well-known study in the US by the Williams Group. And what they did is they studied, I think it was 5,000 wealthy families, you know, business-focused families, and they looked at the loss of the business. Again, if you look at that study, the vast majority of the time that the loss occurred was, number one, people not being aligned, people not really talking to each other, people not getting on the same page, having a plan together. And number two was that the heirs weren't prepared to receive that wealth. So what you can see here is, if you want to tackle these two points, then it's kind of straightforward what you need to do in theory, which is you need to get people lined up. You need to get people planning and talking about this stuff. But also you need to get the next generation prepared to understand, look, they're getting this wealth in the future. Do they understand the value of this? Do they understand what they should be doing with it? Do they understand their own personal cash flow and ways in which they're actually going to be able to hold on to this wealth and make it achieve what they want it to and make it last in most cases?
Well, from the Bank of Mum and Dad being the largest lender in the UK to 36% of millennials factoring in an inheritance to 10,000 wills contested, you've certainly given us a lot to talk about today. Thank you so much for joining us, Warwick Bloor at Vanguard.
No problem. Pleasure. Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, will your next best designer purchase be in a charity shop? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and there are nearly 500 charity shops in Ireland, and it seems their time might now have come, as there's so much talk these days about the circular economy. And to look at these issues around the economic and the social value of charity shops, I'm delighted to be joined by Esther Pugh, who is a senior lecturer in retail marketing and consumer behaviour at Leeds Beckett University. And I'm also joined by retail consultant Eddie Shanahan, who has been travelling the high streets of Ireland for many years. Hello to you both.
Hi there.
Hello.
Esther, can we start with you, please? I'm a big charity shop fan, I have to say, and for a couple of reasons. From an affordability point of view as a student, but today as somebody, I have to say, I'm not a very talented shopper, so I love the low risk nature of buying in a charity shop and the really good value that I can find. Can you characterise today's charity shop customer, please?
Oh, well, there's multiple different types of shoppers in the charity shops today. They've become super sort of diverse environments for shoppers. So some people love to treasure hunt, such as me. Everything I possess is from charity shops. I will seek out all those wonderful finds, and I'm happy to hunt through boxes and, you know, the proper thrift store environment. However, some charity shops have become super sophisticated today, and they really are competition for the full price store on the high street. So we have boutiques, vintage boutiques, and we have superstores. So the different types of shoppers are those who are going for economic motives, who perhaps couldn't afford certain brands full price. Then there's the treasure hunters like myself, who just like to find something different and enjoy the experience. And there's others who just enjoy taking part in that circular economy and feeling, like you say, low risk, but also you're doing something good for the environment.
And if we culturally just take a look around the world, in the US, we have about 19,000 used merchandise stores. As you say, sometimes they're called thrift stores, and then that can also include consignment stores, etc. In Australia, there's about 2,400 op shops, as they're called there. And 75% of citizens reported buying secondhand items in the past year in Sweden. How big is this industry in the UK?
Well, it's growing, and the stigma that was once attached to buying secondhand goods has long gone. And now those goods are seen as often superior because they've got histories, they've got stories behind them. You can find unique and individual pieces. People are becoming bored with the identikit high street of fast fashion, for example. So it's growing in size. However, there's multiple challenges. We may come onto this, but lots of challenges for the high street charity shop today.
Eddie, can I come to you, please? Because 3.3% of all retail outlets in the UK are charity shops. And you've been involved with looking at Ireland's Main Street over the past few years. Well, many years. What have you noticed about the charity shop retail offering in Ireland?
It's definitely improving and their retail capability is improving. But first, let me say we should stop calling them charity shops because many of them have rebranded. And, you know, I prefer if we talk about designer exchanges, about pre-loved stores, about retro stores, about treasure stores. But calling them charity shops is poor branding. And many of them have moved on and they've moved away from the secondhand thrift label. That doesn't mean people don't go there for cheaper clothes, but many people now are going there to find a treasure trove of vintage with a strong design quotient, a great backstory, excellent craftsmanship and quality as well, and clothes that are lasting longer. I mean, the new mantra is buy less, buy better. And as we move to defeat fast fashion, that is one key way to do it, coupled with education. And there's an opportunity for the charity shops to take an even bigger market share by continuing the path they're on at the moment, where they're developing their retail skills from their window displays to their in-store merchandising to the quality of the staff. Many of them now have a very professional approach to staff training rather than just relying on, while they were well-intentioned, just volunteers. But now you can get the backstory. That story adds value, adds interest, and adds collectability to the product. And if you want an example of how the type of fashion that's bequeathed, if you like, to those particular stores, if you want to understand how those pieces can inflate in value, just look at Hermes, for example, where in a very short period of time, if you're lucky enough to be able to invest in an Hermes bag for the first time, it's probably a better investment than vintage wine.
Or the Hermes shares, actually, which I now feel I must go and investigate after this conversation. Thank you for giving me so many synonyms, actually, for the term charity shop as well, Eddie. I've noted down several of them here and listeners will hear me refer to them now. Esther, I find it really interesting that 22 million UK adults shopped in a pre-loved store in any given three-month period, while 25 million donate goods in a three-month period. That's telling us that more people donate than buy. And is that causing a problem then for the retail store?
Well, actually, this is something that I'm currently doing research on, and I'm looking at donation behaviour. And what we often find is that those donors, are different people than the shoppers. There is a huge glut of possessions today. People have more and more stuff. They're often clearing out. But a lot of that stuff is of poor quality. So this is one of the biggest challenges for charity shops today. We've spoken about designer pieces and wonderful treasures and vintage goods. Some of those are becoming more and more scarce and rare and harder to come by because a lot of the stuff that's being given to charity shops is the fast fashion and the lower priced items. And charity shops have to recycle them. They can't necessarily resell them on. So there's multiple challenges around donation. The other one is around the likes of Vinted and Depop. People now are monetizing their own possessions. And if they're clearing out their wardrobes, they are going to sell those things on Vinted for a few pounds instead of give them to a charity shop.
I think I was just having this conversation today with two fabulous women in their 20s, Ruth and Erica, about Vinted and Depop. And I was asking that question, are they competitors to your traditional second-hand retailer? Because, of course, as you say there, you can make money from selling on those versus a donation to a charity shop. But can I also ask, in that same vein, Eddie, in general, is designer exchanges and the ability to sell on goods in the whole circular economy, is that posing a challenge then to traditional retail?
Oh, it absolutely is. Just like outlet stores are providing a challenge, but it's horses for courses. I think the opportunity to get some control over the donation problem is that we have new rules coming in around circularity and sustainability, and they will impact as well on how companies, retailers and manufacturers can or cannot dispose of excess inventory. And I think that will take some of the pressure away in terms of donations outstripping demand. I mean, currently we have on those channels that have just been mentioned, like Depop, and that we do have consumers trying to monetize the rubbish they bought from fast fashion outlets. And therefore, the quality, I think, cannot be compared to what the genuine history of these stores has been previously. And we need to get back to that. You've got a lot of the fast fashion bricks and mortar outlets, for example, giving vouchers in return for garments returned, and those garments then can be burned or disposed of. Not for very much longer, they can't. So I think we will see a rebalancing in terms of the value of donations and how these shops, whether they be pre-loved, vintage or designer exchanges, actually assess the garments that are sent to them. And I think you will see them upping their game in terms of the quality of the merchandise they offer and what they will actually accept as donations from here on in.
Of course, you need people to do all of that. Everything that Eddie has just mentioned, you need people. And I have a friend, her name is Lara. She volunteers at a charity shop in the US and she loves it. And I see that in the UK, 1.6 million fewer people are volunteering overall in 2023 in comparison to the year prior. What are the challenges today facing these shop owners?
Well, the challenges facing any shop owners are to get committed staff. So that's not just an issue for these vintage stores or pre-loved stores or exchanges to get committed staff, but there is a sea change now. As you said at the top of the interview here, their time has come for these shops. The new circular regulations mean that the market is swinging in their direction. They now have the responsibility to react to that in a very professional manner and do what they've already started, become professional retailers with professional staff on the floor that are paid a living wage.
And Esther, what's your take on that?
My take on that is that I think volunteering is really brilliant for local communities, for well-being, for giving young people opportunities to get work experience. And it's something that I actively encourage with all of my students who are studying marketing degrees. So we create charity pop-up shops and all of our students design the shop, create the experience, run the shop, and they volunteer for Oxfam in the process of doing it. And they find it incredibly rewarding to volunteer for a charity store.
I see value in that. Don't get me wrong, but you know, a cake sale is not the same as running a bakery.
I take the point on that. And of course, the sense of bringing people in and paying them, as you say, a living wage is all about professionalising the shop in that case. What lessons do you think traditional retail, Eddie, can take from the existing vintage or the retro store?
Well, their time has come as well, in terms of they can't now just rely on a race to the bottom. We have seen on the high street certainly a reduction in quality over the last probably 10 years or more in terms of brands that are being stocked. I mean, if you take menswear, for example, you know, the jackets that barely have enough material to cover the halfway down your back, the skinny fits and so on. And consumers now are beginning to question, since the pandemic, the whole value and craftsmanship of what they're buying, whether it's homewares or whether it's fashion. And I think the retailers are, the classic retailer is now going to find that these shops are serious competitors in a world that values recycling, that values sustainability and longevity, and that puts quality and craftsmanship before fast fashion.
Well, Esther, as we're coming to the end of this conversation, I found another interesting, well, two numbers here. 2 in 3 people prefer to donate rather than sell their items. And that giving a nod back to the Depop and Vinted note. But the other thing is that the average spend per visit is £7. Now, I think of the enormous value I've gotten over the years in design. As I say, I have a list of them here in vintage stores, we'll say, over the years. And like the average spend per visit is £7. There's sometimes I can spend quite a while in there because, as I say, it's low risk. So I can take my time and try on plenty of things. And I've discovered all sorts of really, really lovely items, but also whether it's household items, etc. What are, do you find, the motivations of people to visit a store like this, apart from simply looking for something to buy?
Well, the reason for visiting a charity shop, thrift store, vintage store, whatever, all secondhand environments, is to find something unique and different that feels authentic, that is well made and well produced, that is a quality item, something that has maybe nostalgia attached to it. Often shopping in these stores is a bit like visiting a museum. You know, you only have to listen to people's conversations, which I've done in my research, talking about, oh, do you remember when we used to have that as a child? And you know, lots of things have that real history attached to them. So it's fun and it's enjoyable. The price is a great motivator, as you say, the low risk, but also it's the serendipity. The biggest thing is you never know what you're going to find. No one goes into a charity store with a list. This is what I'm looking for. You have to have an open mind, and then it can just be really fun and enjoyable.
Absolutely. I concur with that completely. Eddie, can I just ask you one last question before we go? And that is, what are the general trends you're seeing in retail around the world generally? So are we seeing a rise in e-commerce? Are we seeing a rise in the request for sustainability? Are we seeing more price consciousness? Like what's going on out there in general?
Well, we've been seeing a rebalancing in e-commerce since the pandemic ended, and people are going back to bricks and mortar stores continuing to research online, and now treating retail as a multi-channel operation. So you might research in store and order online, or vice versa. Or you might do click and collect. That's one thing. Of course, then we've had the disruption caused by Mr. Trump and his tariffs. That is impacting seriously on some of the big players in the fast fashion market. And that's probably the only one thing I like that Mr. Trump has done since he came back into office. But also, we are seeing customers now being much more assertive in how they seek value. So the opportunity to tell stories, the backstories of those beautiful pieces and treasures that you can find in these shops is certainly very important. And training the team in the store to project those stories and to know about them and to understand the merchandise they have on their rails, just like staff are expected to do or should be doing in a traditional store, that's becoming more and more important. So I think people will go there to discover, to delight in those discoveries, but they will still expect the level of service to improve as the popularity of the stores improves.
Thank you so much indeed to Esther Pugh and Eddie Shanahan for joining me today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week at Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullet, and I hope you enjoyed the show and that you possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I just want to remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And of course, if you do listen to it on a podcast, please do share the link in your WhatsApp groups as well to anybody else who you feel might be interested in hearing what we have to say. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of this gorgeous day, and I look forward to chatting to you again next week.